Live to see it, friends. I'm Phil Bauermaster, and this is Fast Forward Radio. We're very pleased to have our special guest on this edition of Fast Forward Radio, Aubrey de Grey, who is with the Department of Genetics at Cambridge University. Aubrey is the co-founder of the Methuselah Mouse Prize and the originator of the concept of SENS, Strategies for Engineered Negligible Senescence, which is kind of a mouthful, but we'll get into what that means. And with me, as always, is Stephen Gordon. Hello, Stephen.
Hi. How are you doing, Phil? And how are you doing, Aubrey?
I'm doing fine, thank you.
Very good. Aubrey, I'll give you the opportunity to do as you often do. Explain to us, for the audience that may not know, what SENS is.
SENS is an attempt to develop a way to really fix human aging, eventually. It's a long-term effort. I don't expect it to be working for humans for maybe 25 years, and if we're unlucky, it could be much longer than that. But the sooner we start, the sooner we'll finish. And the reason I'm confident that we have a fair chance of getting there within something like 25 or 30 years is because SENS is a very detailed plan. It focuses on the accumulation of various types of molecular and cellular damage that occur as intrinsic side effects of our normal metabolic processes, so that's to say a side effect of being alive in the first place, and the role that those microscopic types of damage have in eventually leading to age-related diseases and also age-related loss of function that we don't call disease, like impaired immune system or loss of muscle, for example. The reason I think it's possible to describe a pretty detailed way to go about this is because it focuses on the accumulating damage itself and not on the precise mechanisms that cause that damage to accumulate. And the advantage of that is that we still don't know very much about how cells work, let alone about how organisms work. There's an enormous amount that we don't yet know. And so in order to come up with a design for a really good intervention that has a chance of working, we'd have to try to sidestep as much as possible of our ignorance. And that's a way of doing that, to focus on the damage itself. For example, mutations accumulate in our DNA, and if we can make sure that those mutations don't matter, then it doesn't matter how the mutations happen.
Sidestepping our ignorance, that may be part of the tension that led to the SENS challenge.
I think it probably was part of the tension that has led to skepticism about my ideas from many of my colleagues, because it's very counter to the way that most gerontologists think. Most gerontologists are basic scientists. They're interested in understanding aging, and so the idea of avoiding the necessity to understand something is counter to what they're about. It just sort of doesn't compute. Whereas I'm thinking in a more goal-directed way, I'm perfectly willing to say that my ultimate goal is to actually do something about aging, and that's why I'm interested in aging. And so it's much less of a conflict for me. This is actually a real problem in the biology of aging, that there are these sorts of boundaries that some people, many people in fact, feel scared of saying that they would like to do something about aging. That there's so much fear of being pigeonholed with snake oil merchants that people try to pretend that aging is actually not such a bad thing after all, or that they, it's a bad thing, but they're not personally interested in doing anything to fix it. And these sorts of boundaries between the curiosity-driven work and the goal-directed work are really damaging. They don't exist in other fields. If you work on cancer, you may be basically interested in working out how cancer works rather than in fixing it. But there's no shame in saying that the ultimate goal is to fix it. In aging, there is some sort of shame in that, and that's one thing that I'm trying to break down.
And in fact, Aubrey, would you agree that it would be accurate to say that the entry into the SENS challenge that did the best, at least according to the criterion of winning part of the prize money, was actually focused on attempting to present SENS as snake oil?
Well, at least that's pseudoscience, that's right. So, yeah, very much similar to snake oil. Basically, to present my approach to developing these ideas as unjustifiably selective or as dismissive of work that was legitimate, that sort of thing. And certainly, anyone who does do that, who is, who ignores inconvenient data, is definitely not going to do good work. And if I did that, I wouldn't be doing good work. But of course, as I was able to demonstrate rather comprehensively, I'm not doing that at all. And in fact, it was my accusers who were being unjustifiably selective.
How so?
Oh, well, in a variety of ways. I mean, I wrote in my rebuttal to the Sense Challenge a list of different examples of where things that, where they were accusing me of having ignored such and such a thing, that I'd written multiple papers addressing in detail, things like that.
Right.
Aubrey, full disclosure for our audience, I don't think it's much of a secret that Phil and I both were rooting for you in this in the challenge. I got to tell you, I was a little worried, though. You know, had it gone another way, had you had a different panel that might not have been truly impartial, not only would the Methuselah Foundation have lost $10,000, but the work you were doing would have taken a terrible hit.
And that's probably true, but of course that's the experiment. You know, I don't do experiments in the laboratory. I encourage other people to do the experiments that I feel need to be done, but I need to be sure, I need to have the evaluation of independent experts that my ideas are legitimate and are a promising way to go. And, of course, one can do that to a certain extent simply by writing them up for publication in peer-reviewed journals, which I do all the time. But some people take the view that it's quite easy to get things published, and if you're persistent, and therefore that's not enough of a test. And so it was important to me to have something like this that, with a truly independent evaluation of my ideas from people with no axe to grind. And if it had gone the other way, then, you know, that would have been a legitimate statement that I might have been actually, you know, harming the field, wasting people's time with illegitimate ideas. So, you know, if that were the case, then the sooner it's discovered and established, the better, as far as I'm concerned, just like anybody else. I'm not in this for, you know, prestige or ego. I'm in this in order to accelerate the defeat of human aging.
So, since you know you're legit, you welcome the opportunity to take on a challenge like this and get your message out there a little more.
Well, that's one way of putting it, but really what I wanted to emphasize in my last answer was that I don't know that I'm legitimate. I simply have proposals which I think are legitimate, but which are, like any other scientific idea, appropriate to examine by independent experts who may have expertise that I don't have. So I was certainly expecting the challenge to go well, but I was prepared that if it didn't go well, there would be a good reason why it didn't go well. The very important thing was to make sure that the panel, the people who were judging the thing, were independent with no particular reason, no particular vested interest, and also were really eminent expert people whose views could not be ignored. And that was what we achieved.
You know, it occurs to me that we've talked this far into it without actually explaining what the SENS challenge is. Aubrey, could you give us a little bit of background on what that was?
Sure, yeah. It came about it came about as a sort of fallout of an article and a couple of editorials that the MIT Technology Review published in February of last year. And these articles were quite critical of me and my ideas, but they didn't say why. They didn't include any analysis of the science. They relied entirely on other people's evaluations. And in particular, they relied on other people's off-the-record evaluations, dismissal of my work. So when it became clear that this was considered to be inadequate, and that MIT Technology Review really had a bit of a duty as a leading technology magazine not to, state such strong opinions about someone's work without being able to back them up, Jason Pontin, the editor of Technology Review, decided that he needed to go and actually get a mainstream gerontologist to present a nice, succinct demolition of SENS that would justify what had been published. And he tried, he approached a number of gerontologists asking them to do this, and he couldn't get anyone to do it. And eventually, after some discussion with me and my colleague in the Methuselah Foundation, Dave Goebel, we all agreed that the thing to do would be to offer a substantial amount of money, $20,000, half of which came from Technology Review and half of it from the Methuselah Foundation, as a cash prize that would be won by anyone who could write such a thing, a succinct and persuasive argument that sense was not just wrong, but so wrong that it shouldn't even be discussed, and that would convince independent experts of that. And that was all announced last summer. It took quite a while to put together the panel of experts who were willing to judge the submissions, but we did it eventually. And as you know, there were three submissions. Two of them were single author things from gerontologists or other biologists who really didn't understand sense very well and whose challenges to it, whose criticisms of it were easy to dismiss, to rebut. Because, of course, the way the thing worked was that the submitter sends in their thing, and then the first thing that happens is that I write a rebuttal. And the original submission and the rebuttal both went to the panel of adjudicators simultaneously. The third entry was a bit more substantive in the sense that it was written by a consortium of nine people, most of whom are very established gerontologists. It was a good deal more detailed in the specifics of its challenges to sense, to various components of sense. And also, it was unbelievably rude. It was even more strongly worded than the original editorials that MIT Technology Review had published back in February of 2005. But as you have said, the panel weren't very impressed with any of that. The orchestrator of this entry, Pete Ester, was sufficiently enraged at having not won the challenge that he wrote a dissent, which is available on the Technology Review website, in which he basically says that he lost only because the judges are not experts and basically generally called into question their ability to judge these things. And I think that tells you a great deal more about him than about anything else.
Right.
Yep. Craig Venter, not an expert, I guess. I understand that Technology Review actually paid as a consolation prize their half.
Not exactly their half. I mean, it's a challenge prize, so the challenge is still open. And if someone were in the future to write an entry which did persuade the judges that I am talking nonsense, then they would get the full $20,000. So the money that was given by Technology Review unilaterally, not with any consultation of the Methuselah Foundation, the money that was given was additional money that that Jason Fontin just decided to give as a sort of, as you say, consolation prize. But it didn't fool anybody, as you see.
I thought that what David Goebel had to say after that was right on point. They could write any kind of check they like, but it's definitely outside the contest. And nobody should be confused as to whether they won or not. They did not win.
That's right.
I wonder if the arguments against SENS could be summed up as essentially, one, this is a real problem that is too far beyond our capability to solve to be something serious even to talk about, or two, and I think this is the one that doesn't get articulated as much, but simply, this is something we shouldn't be messing with at all. In the end, does it all kind of come down to being one of those two things?
I think it comes down to both of them, but it comes down to the first one, the business about it too hard, when one talks to gerontologists, and it comes down to the second one, you know, fear of the unknown, you know, faith in the natural order, all that sort of nonsense. It comes down to that when you talk to other people, non-biologists, and also biologists who do not work on aging. People who do work on aging tend to understand that aging is genuinely a very bad thing indeed, and that if we could do something about it, we definitely should. The difficulty is that many of my ideas are based on science that has not historically been considered part of gerontology. And so these are ideas where my colleagues in gerontology simply don't know the literature very well. They would have to not just read my papers on these topics, they would also have to extensively read the papers, the experimental work that I reference in my papers, so as to be sufficiently up to speed to be able to evaluate in an educated way the feasibility of my proposals. And since they haven't done that, the only option they have as an alternative, as a fallback, is to evaluate my proposals on the basis of my conclusions, which is, of course, very unreliable. The fact that I say that this has the potential to extend lifespan indefinitely is something that's immensely more ambitious and more optimistic than anything that any other gerontologist said about any other intervention that's on the table, and that simple conclusion is enough to make many gerontologists feel that I must be talking nonsense, even though they haven't inspected the detail. There is, of course, the third issue of the political problem. People, as I said earlier, people in gerontology are very worried about being associated with snake oil salesmen, so anything that sounds like might be nonsense, they want to keep a distance from, even if they don't actually know whether it is nonsense.
And that conservatism leads to kind of the maintenance of the status quo.
Well, of course, that's right. And of course, this is not something that has never that's new in science. It happens all the time. I think it was about 80 years ago that Max Planck made this famous observation that science progresses funeral by funeral, and it's just as true now as it ever was.
Yeah, I think the updated kind of politically correct version of that is that science precedes retirement by retirement. But for this particular case, the funeral by funeral argument is just all the stronger, isn't it?
That's right.
There was an article in the New York Times, I guess it was probably about 2 weeks ago, that talked about just generally how much healthier people are in the 21st century, and they were looking specifically at the U.S., than in, say, the 19th century. And the notion was there that those folks might have been even quite a bit healthier than people from a century before that. Well, I picked up on that and wrote an entry on it in one of my blogs, and I read an interesting response from a blogger who's a doctor who took issue. Actually, he wasn't really responding to me so much as to Glenn Reynolds, linking to the story in the first place. But he came back with a, well, is longer life as an end unto itself really something we should be shooting for kind of response. And I want to read just a little bit of some of the questions he asked, and I'd like to get your response to them. He wrote, is it a positive good to live to age 90, spending the last 10 or more years with dementia, not knowing who you are nor recognizing your own friends or family? Is it a positive good to be kept alive by aggressive medical therapy for heart failure or emphysema, yet barely able to function physically? Is it worthwhile undergoing highly toxic chemotherapy or disfiguring surgery to cure cancer, thereby sparing a life then severely impaired by the treatment which saved that life? How would you respond to that kind of characterization of the growing interest that people have in life extension?
I think these are very hard questions, very, very difficult dilemmas that, of course, as you say, doctors face even today. And therefore, it's a great relief to me that I don't need to have any opinions on those questions in order to know that the sort of therapies that I work on are a positive good. And the reason I don't need to know is because the sort of therapies I work on are bona fide rejuvenation therapies that will repair at the molecular and cellular level the accumulated damage that happens, as I mentioned earlier, as a side effect of being alive in the first place. And therefore, they will actually render people more healthy, more fit, higher quality of life than beforehand, as well as making them live longer. The goal is what I've been calling longevity escape velocity, which means improving the quality and comprehensiveness of these therapies faster than time is passing, or if you want slightly more precise, faster than the things that we can't yet fix are catching up with us. But the overall effect is essentially equivalent to eliminating aging completely, so that the concept of an extension of the time at the end of life when you're frail or diseased or demented or whatever, doesn't apply at all. In fact, that period will be compressed to nothing because it will be being pushed out into the future faster than time is passing. People will be getting, in a real sense, biologically younger as they're getting chronologically older.
Right. Well, clearly that's an excellent response to those questions. But as I read it, I just felt like, you know, the lady doth protest too loudly. I mean, when I read, is it a positive good to have chemotherapy and be sick for the rest of your life or to live with dementia? I mean, who would say yes to that? To me, it seems like these are straw man arguments.
Well, it doesn't relate to life extension in the way that life extension is actually going to be done. It's not a
right.
straw man argument in the wider sense, because certainly it does apply to a number of the therapies, the expensive and laborious and questionable therapies that are used to keep people alive these days in a state where we can't repair them and restore them to you. But it
right.
doesn't apply at all to the sort of therapies that I work on.
Exactly.
Well, Aubrey, you said earlier that science progresses funeral by funeral. will science or society as a whole grow stagnant if funerals are eliminated?
Well, first of all, let's remember that funerals won't be completely eliminated. We're still going to have trucks to walk in front of accidentally and so on.
That's a relief.
However, the other point is that I think we can certainly be quite sure that there will be very profound changes to society resulting from the elimination of aging, or the making of aging voluntary. And one of those things, I think one of the most certain things, is that people will start to have multiple careers to a greater extent than now. Of course, this is happening already. People are moving into new careers at later ages at a much greater rate than they ever used to, but it's still a relatively minority activity. I think that's going to be the rule. And that means that if you've been a journalist for 40 years or whatever, and you then retire on your savings or on state pension, of course retirement won't be permanent anymore because that wouldn't be economically sustainable, but it also wouldn't be psychologically sustainable. You wouldn't want to carry on playing golf for the rest of your life if you were still youthful and vigorous and, wanted and were in a state to be wanting new challenges. You would want to go back into higher education, adult education, and get retrained and become something else for the next 40 years. And it seems to me that that will be a very powerful force against the sort of societal or cognitive stagnation that people worry about.
Absolutely.
And one of the things I think we would see in a world like that, one of the things that I hope we will see, is the new kind of perspective that a person might have who's 75, 80, who knows, 100 years old, entering a new career, entering into, say, scientific research, with all the enthusiasm and the clarity of mind of a young person, of someone in their 20s, but with this incredible life experience going into it at the same time.
Well, absolutely, yes. You're quite right. It's going to be very interesting.
And I find that so much more interesting than the question of whether we should do it. Of course we should. I mean, you know, it seems to me that the question of whether we should do it, I mean, if there's any way for medicine to address a physical problem, not only should we do it, but it will be done. So the question of what will happen is a lot more interesting, it seems to me, than whether we should do it.
Well, yes, it's certainly true that whatever can happen, can be developed, probably will be developed. However, people who are genuinely, sincerely opposed to any particular technology will say, well, at least if we can't stop it happening forever, we might be able to stop it happening for a while, and that's better than nothing. So I think one does have to point to genuine arguments why opponents of this way forward are wrong. And that's why I take such trouble to emphasize that it's no surprise that the majority of the population are scared, I guess, of the possibility of aging becoming voluntary. I think it's just fear of the unknown. You know, it's a psychological thing. You know, the fact is that aging has, for all of our recorded and, of course, before that history, been inevitable, as well as being obviously very horrible. And if something is very horrible but it's inevitable, then one has a choice. One can either be preoccupied by it and have it, you know, get one down, or one can try and put it out of one's mind and get on with one's miserably short life and, you know, make the best of it. And I think that while aging really is inevitable, it's perfectly rational to take that second choice, put it out of your mind. And it doesn't matter how irrational the reasons are that you make up and that you convince yourself of, that allow you to put it out of your mind. It's only now, when we are getting into range of being able to do something about aging in the relatively foreseeable future, that pro-aging trance, as I call it, becomes part of the problem and starts to inhibit people's willingness to agitate to make this happen as soon as we technically can.
Well, isn't it partly the case that the very understandable, as you said, rationalization for this became a kind of fundamental truth in its own right? And even beyond that, sometimes when I have discussions with people about this, it goes all the way to the point where this is a good thing, right? Where people will talk about, you know, the circle of life and how it's just a beautiful thing that we're young and we're vital and then we get old and we're dead. And it just seems like it went a step farther than it even needed to for the psychological boost.
Well, I think that's part of the psychological thing. You know, taking a position that's so outrageous that the person who's bringing up the subject can't even think of an answer is a way of changing the subject.
Right.
Which is ultimately what the person wants.
Now, you had mentioned the Methuselah Foundation. Why don't you tell us about that and about the Methuselah Mouse Prize?
Sure. The Methuselah Foundation was put together in 2002. By me and Dave Goebel, who is, I suppose, a serial entrepreneur from the Washington, D.C. area. And we make a marvelous team because he's not a scientist, but he has an immense amount of experience and expertise in business and public relations and such like. He already had actually established a 501c3, a non-profit charity that we could use to accept tax-deductible donations. So if you go to mprize.org, you'll find that you can simply give us some money on your credit card. And there are two major activities that the Methuselah Foundation pursues that we use your money for. The first one is the Methuselah Mouse Prize that you just mentioned. That was set up in, I suppose, late 2002, early 2003. And the idea there is simply to offer money for people who can create longer-lived mice than have ever been created before. And the amount of money that we award, of course, depends on how much we have in the prize fund, and the prize fund is currently in the region of $3.5 million. But it also depends on how much you beat the previous record by. You don't get the whole fund, you get a proportion that's defined by the margin of victory over the previous record. So that's one thing that we do. And we actually have two Methuselah Mouse Prizes. The one that's got most of the money in it is called the Rejuvenation Prize, and the reason it's got most of the money is because it's the one that has most relevance to people who are already alive, because it's focused specifically on therapies that one would do to mice only after they've reached middle age, where they were completely normal both genetically and in terms of their diet or drugs or anything. Nothing had been done to them at all until they were already in middle age. Anyway, so that's the Methuselah Mouse Prize. And more recently, we have broadened the ambit of the Methuselah Foundation also to include the funding of Centre Research, of the sort of research that I think needs to be funded. I'm the chairman of the Methuselah Foundation, but I'm also the chief science officer, and therefore it makes sense for me to be using the Methuselah Foundation as the platform to orchestrate and coordinate the funding of research that may be difficult to fund from traditional sources simply because it's too ambitious or the ultimate goals are not considered appropriate or whatever. And that's beginning to ramp up now. At the moment we have a few $100,000 only in the fund, but we're hoping to be able to raise that pretty quickly.
Is there work ongoing at this moment that seems to have some promise?
There are lots of... The whole sense effort I normally divide into seven major themes, major strands. And some of those strands are going very well, thank you, without my assistance, especially stem cell work. You know, cell therapy is a field, of course, that's in the news all the time. And there's a lot of work going on. Some of it is somewhat restricted in the US, of course, embryonic stem cell research. But nevertheless, it's a very big field. And I don't see any need to have the Methuselah Foundation throw more money at that aspect. There are some other aspects of SENS, strands of SENS, that are also quite well advanced. They could probably do with further injections of cash, but their theme is generally established, and some of them are already in clinical trials. For example, the elimination of indigestible molecules that accumulate in the spaces between our cells, which are normally called amyloid. This is a field which is particularly interesting to people who work on Alzheimer's disease, because one type of amyloid is the senile plaque, which is made of a protein called amyloid beta that accumulates in the brain. A lot of people think that that's part of the process that causes Alzheimer's. So people are trying to work to get rid of that stuff, and there's a technique that involves essentially immunizing against it, which is already in clinical trial. So that's going pretty well. There's another area which is basically the unstiffening of material that ought to be elastic and becomes less elastic with age. The best example is the artery wall, which, so the reason why blood pressure tends to go up with age is because the artery wall becomes less elastic. Another example is the lens of the eye, which becomes less elastic, and that's why you can't see things close up so easily when you're older. Again, there's a drug now in clinical trials which helps to reverse that stiffening by breaking the chemical bonds that spontaneously form as a side effect of normal metabolism that cause the stiffening in the first place. The ones that I spend most of my effort on are actually the ones that are furthest away from implementation, and that's really the reason why I work on them. They're the ones that need most help. So one of them is making copies of the mitochondrial DNA and putting it in the nucleus. This is a very ambitious thing, and a lot of people think it's so ambitious we shouldn't even try, but a number of better informed experimental scientists, very good scientists, are sufficiently persuaded that this is worth doing, that they certainly would be trying to do it if they had the money, and so I want to solve that problem.
So when you talk about these kinds of specific research efforts, and I'd like to get more deeply into this business of moving the mitochondrial DNA into the nucleus, but generally speaking, this kind of research, does this relate directly to the effort to create the world's longest-lived mouse?
In fact, rather the opposite. The reason why the Bethesda Foundation has these two activities is because they complement each other. SENSE is a very rationally designed, coordinated effort that's got lots of bits to it, and the bits have to be implemented. So that takes money. But the Methuselah Mouse Prize exists precisely because we don't know that SENSE is going to work. Prizes have an extraordinarily good track record for bringing a lot of money into the effort to implement some particular technology. And the areas in which they work best are the areas in which it's not really clear what technology is going to work. And so you want to encourage people to follow their hunches and try a lot of different things at their own expense, of course, initially. They get the prize only at the end if they succeed. You want to encourage people to follow their hunches. Something like the Apollo project, for example, is at the other end of the spectrum, where everyone who's working in the field does basically know what's involved, but it really just takes a large injection of cash. Where we are with life extension at the moment is midway between those two. We have a good plan that has a fair chance of working, but we don't know that it's going to work. So it makes sense to hedge our bet and also have a prize.
Now, one of the things I really like about the Methuselah Mouse Prize website is the opportunity to actually see where the mice are, how they're ranking and so forth. We've linked to that on occasion on The Speculist and talked about new milestones with the mouse living a particularly long period of time, that kind of thing. I wonder, is there a watershed mouse age that we're shooting for? So if, say, a mouse has lived, I don't know what it would be, 5 years or 10 years, would we be able to say we've made a quantum leap, that we're really on our way? Or does it work that way?
Well, the structure of the current prize doesn't have any particular milestone. It just says, you know, we keep on trying to improve and improve and improve. And there's some value in that because, you know, we're never going to have done everything. So it's always worthwhile to have this prize that persists. However, there is also a lot of sense in identifying a milestone, a degree of life extension that is something to aim for, that would be enough that it would give sufficient confidence to the rest of the world, to the wider scientific community and to the wider world, that, you know, we really had entered a new phase in this research, and true life extension for humans was relatively foreseeable, whereas most scientists, of course, currently don't feel that. And so I actually identified a particular milestone, which I call robust mouse rejuvenation, which I think does that. And what that is one has to take mice that are already relatively long-lived naturally, because it's no good using mice that have something congenitally wrong with them that makes them live rather short lives in the first place. So that means typically mice of a strain that lives at least 3 years. And then we have to do a therapy that only starts late in life. So in other words, I say for this milestone, we do nothing at all to these mice until they're already age 2. Okay? So they're already in middle age. They've got a year to live.
Right.
And at that point, we do a bunch of stuff to them, and the milestone is to treble their remaining lifespan. So that rather than only living one more year from age 2 when the therapies begin, they live 3 more years. A total of 5. I think that's the sort of level of combat of aging in mice that would be needed to convince society, and well, first of all, to convince the scientific community, and thereby to convince society that, you know, we're not in Kansas anymore.
Well, I have to say, speaking as a human who's lived at least half of his lifespan, I think that's an excellent way to go with the mice.
Aubrey, would that be equivalent to, say, a 50-year-old person? I mean, if you were able to do it in mice and then duplicate that in humans, are you talking about a 50-year-old person getting another 60 years, or what are you talking about?
Well, that would be the, maybe 55 or 60-year-old person getting another 60 years. That's right. That would be the proportional increase.
Okay.
Actually, I do talk about a corresponding milestone, robust human rejuvenation, but I define it slightly differently. I say that for this purpose, really, we only have to double the remaining lifespan rather than trebling it. In other words, only add another 30 years to the lifespan of someone who's already 55 or 60. And the reason I choose this slightly more modest milestone for humans is because, first of all, humans are, of course, harder to fix in the first place because we are already rather good at not aging compared to mice. But secondly, and more importantly, 30 years is long enough. It's long enough because an awful lot happens in technology in 30 years if society is trying. You know, really radical improvements happen in more or less any technology in that sort of period. So it seems to me that if we can reach a point of being able to give middle-aged people an extra 30 years of life, and let's remember that this will be all healthy life by virtue of the therapy being rejuvenation therapy, if we can do that, then we will be able to spend those 30 years developing improvements to the therapies, and 30 years later, those people who we treated will be in biologically the same sort of state that they were in when we, before we treated them, okay, even though they're 30 years older. So that means that they will be available as potential beneficiaries of the second generation therapies that are 30 years improved. And that is a lot of improvement on average, so the chances are that we will be able to rejuvenate them even more thoroughly and give them maybe another 50 years of healthy life that time, and so on. As we, but the idea is the therapies will be improving faster than the things that we haven't yet worked out how to fix are causing debilitation and disease and so on.
Aubrey, it seems to me that perhaps scientists find that level of faith in future technology to be maybe part of the reason they have trouble with that, but it also reminds me of how the Human Genome Project began. They began knowing that at the pace that they were going at the beginning that it'd be 100 years before they finished the project, but they started with the understanding that that technology would improve.
Yes, absolutely right. Of course, pessimists would say, well, the Human Genome Project was an exception, and it's hard to give a persuasive rebuttal to that. I think you're right, though. I think the Human Genome Project is exactly the exemplar of what we'll do with aging. However, we can go further, because I'm not really trying to say that the achievement of escape velocity and the, you know, the iterative improvement of technology faster than time is passing is a scientific opinion. It's not an opinion drawn from science, it's an opinion drawn from the history of science and the history of technology. It's just very clear that overwhelmingly often that's the sort of rate at which technology improves. And I think it's perfectly legitimate to use the experience that we have of the history of science and technology as a reason for expecting that we have a good chance of achieving that in respect of human aging. Where I do make a genuine scientific argument, as opposed to an argument from history, is with regard to the technology that we will need in order to get to robust mass rejuvenation in the first place, which I think we could do in 10 years if we had enough funding. And the question, and then of course to move from there to robust human rejuvenation, which I think we would have a 50-50 chance of doing in another 15 years after that, so a total of 25 years from now.
I've often had the discussion with Phil that, you know, if this thing is supported, it'll happen quickly, but even if, say, you Aubrey, decided to take up hunting full-time, the scientific community would eventually stumble upon what they need to begin, you know, anti-aging.
Don't tempt me.
That doesn't offend you. Good.
You know, I said, don't tempt me.
Don't tempt you. Yeah.
Sometimes I wake up and I think that, you know, it's a bit difficult getting out of bed and going down and carrying on, but when I could go punting instead. But no, I mean, sure, that's absolutely true. I think it will happen. I just, you know, I want to make it happen as soon as possible because, let's face it, out of the roughly 150,000 people that die every day around the world, about two-thirds of them die of aging, which is to say they die of causes that young people basically never die of. And, of course, in the developed world, the proportion is much higher than two-thirds. But anyway, we're talking about 100,000 people every day. And, you know, if I can do anything to accelerate progress and bring this technology to implementation even a little bit sooner, then I'll have helped to save an unbelievable number of lives, and I reckon that's probably worth doing.
I agree.
Well, I think we can all agree on that point. And you know, Aubrey, there'll be plenty of time for punting in the 22nd, 23rd century. So just, you know, hang in there for now.
That's what keeps me going.
Yeah. Aubrey, I would also like to ask you, you know, we finally have had the chance now to get you on Fast Forward Radio, but I understand that not too long ago, you were also on another program that's almost as well known as Fast Forward Radio, and that's that you were interviewed by 60 Minutes.
Yeah.
Could you tell us a little bit about that experience?
Well, actually, it was eerily normal. I was warned, actually, of course, since I'm based in the UK, I'm not really familiar with 60 Minutes, but as soon as I started mentioning to friends and colleagues that I had been booked to be interviewed by Molly Safer, I was told, ooh, you've got to be very, very careful here, very on your guard, because 60 Minutes has a reputation for really doing hat-trick jobs on people. So I was, you know, as on my guard as I'm able to be at 9 o'clock in the morning. But really, it was an extremely positive experience. It wasn't that they didn't try to, you know, catch me out at all. I think basically over the previous day, before the interview, while we'd been doing a lot of B-roll, I'd got to know Morley and his producer pretty well, and they had become satisfied that I was for real. And they just didn't feel predisposed to try to, to do anything negative.
Well, that's good. You know, and the other thing might be Morley's not getting any younger after all. Maybe this whole idea has some appeal to him, too.
Perhaps.
So the publicity associated with being on 60 Minutes, was that a help to the Methuselah Foundation at all?
Well, strange to say, it's probably too early to know. Because we were obviously expecting that with an audience of 10 million viewers, we would have quite a lot of feedback coming to us. And we got very little indeed. But in retrospect, maybe that's not quite so surprising as it sounds. Because the fact is that the story I'm telling is a very hard story to believe when you hear it for the first time. You really have to get your head around it and do a bit of exploration and perhaps hear it a lot of times, or at least a couple of times, before you're sufficiently intrigued to go and find out more and actually, you know, send an email or whatever, or look on a website or two. And, you know, that hasn't happened yet, but my plan certainly is to carry on with my relatively high media profile to make sure that I get plenty of what you might call repeat advertising, so that more and more people are aware that this wasn't just some one-off and that I am for real.
Aubrey, how do people get involved and how can people help?
Well, there are basically two things. The first thing we've already mentioned, you can go to mprize.org, and you can read a good deal about the activities of the Methuselah Foundation there. You can put money on your credit card to the Methuselah Mouse Prize or to Send Research, and we're always very grateful. I mentioned that the prize fund and indeed even the Send Research fund are quite big now, but it's not just the total amount in the prize fund that matters, it's the number of donors really as well. The number of individual donors is what makes a strong statement that this has popular support. So even if you've only got $10 or $100 that you're able to give us, your donation will be gratefully received, no question about that. You can also, if you're a scientist or if you want to understand the science more, you can go to my website, sense.org, S-E-N-S, of course, not S-E-N-S-E, and on that site, you'll find a lot of information about the details of SANS. It's not, by and large, written for scientists. All the scientific stuff is there, including all of my published papers and so on, but most of the site is written for a non-scientist, a novice audience, and so I hope it's approachable and that it will tell you stuff about what this work is. And, of course, ways to contact me are on that site, so you can always email me and get answers.
You know, Stephen, it occurs to me that one thing we could do would be to put a link to the Methuselah Foundation, to the Methuselah Mouse Prize pages that Audrey just mentioned on the homepage of The Speculist, hopefully someplace up near the top where people could easily find them, and maybe that would, in a small way, be our part towards helping line up more donors.
Absolutely.
That would be wonderful. One of the pages on my website on sense.org is a page called How You Can Help, and I have a list of about a dozen different sorts of things that people can do depending on what sort of position they have, and one of them certainly says, if you have a website, put a link.
All right. Well, we've got a couple websites, and we will definitely get those links up there.
That's great. Thank you.
I was just going to say, Aubrey, that I want to encourage anybody in the audience as well to go to the MPRIZE. You know, it's mprize.org.
That's right.
Okay, mprize.org. Take a look at that. Also, take a look at the science behind it. And once you get your questions answered, make a donation.
Well, Aubrey, we want to thank you, one, for the work that you're doing, and two, for taking the time to speak with us today.
It was my pleasure. Thank you for having me on the show.
Thank you. Goodbye.
Bye-bye.
Hey, that was great.
He's such a gracious guy and so capable of explaining his viewpoint.
Well, there you have it, Stephen. That, quite a personality. Somebody, with interesting perspective and a real plan to, help improve, you know, is it too much to say the human condition overall?
Well, if he's successful in what he set out to do, he will be a hero. And I know that's not his, you know, that's not what's motivating him. But it seems to me that he will be one of the greats. And it certainly was a privilege to get to visit with him.
Yeah. It's nice of him to take time from his day. And also just nice to get a refresher. Of course, we've interviewed Aubrey before in text form on the site, but really, really great to hear from him, and also to know that we will eventually. We didn't mention in the interview, but we will eventually do a follow up with Dave Goebel, the co-founder of the Methuselah Mouse Prize, who just wasn't able to make it on today's show.
I look forward to that as well, and I'd like to get his take as to how the sentence challenge went and how he felt that that went. I'm probably cut this, Phil, but I was kind of thinking about how, you know, most of us who are pro-life extension feel that, you know, that was a vindication. I'm sure that there would be those on the other side of the equation that would say that, you know, that it was not. But the way the sentence challenge was set up, really the burden of proof was on those who were trying to show that that what Aubrey's doing is not worthy of discussing. And they were not able to meet that burden. So to me, it was a flat out win.
It seems to me that it was too. I kind of question the whole contest, to tell you the truth, in terms of whether, it's a good idea to say, we're going to prove this isn't legitimate, but I think from the standpoint of it, it gave Aubrey a chance to make his case, and it also gave him a chance to show that it was not as easily debunked as could have been suggested. It seems like it's a real net positive.
By that you mean that you question whether it's a good idea to ever start saying this is not worthy of science.
Well, obviously there are things that aren't worthy of science. It seemed to me that was a pretty big leap to make on something that has been approached from a scientific perspective from the beginning, and is intended as a serious scientific endeavor. It felt to me like there's almost a quality of a smear job in setting the contest up in the first place. Although obviously that's not Aubrey's perspective, and again, all's well that ends well, I guess.
That's right. And And also, he was having a bit of trouble. As conservative as the gerontology community is, I think that part of the impetus for Aubrey, and I guess I should have asked him this, was the fact that, you know, he was having some trouble getting peers to look at his ideas, and so
hopefully, if nothing else, this contest has helped clear that hurdle.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And so perhaps more of these ideas will be looked at objectively by more scientists, and that can only speed the progress.
Yes. Well, I think that should just about do us for this edition. I will mention two other things. We do have a new blog, L2SI, which you can find a link to that at speculus.com. And we have a new podcast, which is the L2SI Report. I'm trying to get those out every week. It's